to the Levites. The very title of the book, right? Leviticus means pertaining to the Levites. That's our English title. That's not the title that the Jews used. We'll talk about that later on. But sometimes we think that this book was written only for a very select class. It was for the Old Testament clergy to read. It was their handbook that they kept back on their desk in their office or something like that. That's not the way that they used the book at all. It is full of sacrifices and laws and prohibitions. And, you know, all three of those things are kind of viewed as negatives by people. You know, it's you have to kill animals because of sin and things like that. And you have all these laws that are given. You have to keep track of different things. And there's all these thou shalt nots. And on top of that, as you begin reading through this book, this is the thing that I get most often, is that it's just boring. It's boring, boring, boring. One of the first times that I taught this material, taught through the book of Leviticus, it was at a young ladies' camp in Indiana, Dove Camp, several years ago. And they didn't know what I was going to teach. I got there and it hadn't been announced what I was teaching. And so I started off class and said, "What is your favorite book? If we were going to study your favorite book." And people were just all over the place, you know, Acts, Mark, you know, all kinds of Psalms, all kinds of answers. I said, "Okay, what's your least favorite book?" And there were a couple of other answers, but it was almost unanimous that it was Leviticus. And well, why is that the case? Well, because it's boring. And then I asked that question, "Well, how many times have you studied through it?" Well, no, they hadn't. I told them, I said, "When we finish this study, my goal will be to make Leviticus your second favorite book of the Bible. That's my goal. Because Deuteronomy ought to be your first." You're laughing, I'm not. I just love these books. I mean, you know, think about what books Jesus loved, what books Jesus used, the quotations, you know, the greatest commandment, the second greatest commandment. That's what we're talking about, Deuteronomy and Leviticus, right? You know, the books that we struggle to read through, Jesus was constantly citing, you know, Isaiah, for example. We need to develop more of a Christ-like mentality toward studying, I think. And hopefully we'll do that some. Think about some of these quotes, Psalm 19 and verse 7. "The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. Testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple." The law of the Lord. What was the psalmist talking about there? What, you know, we're Old Testament times. What's the law of the Lord? I think that would include Leviticus. You know, I don't think it's only that, but God's law. Well, that's what a lot of Leviticus is about. And so just understanding that sense that it's what's perfect in converting the soul. Or thinking about Psalm 1, "But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night." That's the mindset that we have to develop. I love studying Acts and, you know, Revelation and a lot of other books that are exciting. Joshua, you know, it's enjoyable studying through the Kings and other passages where you just have a lot of action that's taking place. And you don't have much action in the book of Leviticus. But that doesn't make it a bad book. Not in God's eyes, at least. I forget the artist that drew this. I really like this picture. I don't know if you've seen this one before or not. There's other artist renditions of the children of Israel in the wilderness. And there you've got the tabernacle there in the middle. And you sort of get this picture of the tents going around it. You know, you have the Levites around and then the tribes going around in their order. And as I look at this, I know you're looking at it from a distance there, but one of the things that really strikes me, if you get a chance to look at this up close, it just gives you the impression that the tents just keep on going. That's one of the things that I think is powerful about this. I found a print of this actually in Brazil one time and bought it and carried it all the way back home without destroying it. I was really excited and proud of myself for that. But to me, that just really helps. If I can think about being in God's presence and all of these other people being in God's presence, that's the same goal that we have, right? And so there's a lot of similarities between what God was wanting to accomplish for the Israelites at Mount Sinai and beyond, and for what he's wanting to accomplish with his people today. Instructions, the things that God told the Israelites in Exodus 19, you know, that they were going to be his holy nation, his special people. That's quoted in 1 Peter 2 and verse 9 to talk about us. The same thing that God wanted for his people at Mount Sinai, Exodus 19, 6, is that right? Is the same thing he wants for us, 1 Peter 2 and verse 9. Same, it's a quote. We're to be his people. And so it really behooves us to think about, well, what did he want for them? We're not living under the exact same law, but man, there's so many. We won't be able to touch in 6 weeks all of the applications, all of the references in the New Testament. As you study beyond these 6 weeks, I think you'll be, what I'd really like for you to do is to call me or text me or email me or whatever and just say, hey, Joe, have you seen this one? Because as you're studying other books, as you're studying Ezekiel, as you're studying Revelation, and as you're studying the Gospels, you'll be like, wait, this is Leviticus here. And so text me and ask me if I've seen that. Because then what I'll do is I'll add it to my notes for the next time that I get ready to teach, and it'll even be better. That's how I develop my slides. Any questions or thoughts to this point? I tend to get excited when I'm teaching this book, and that may mean that I go fast and I don't stop for somebody that has a question or a comment. So just, you know, interrupt. Just raise your hand, just say something, and that'll be perfectly fine. Again, because I do get excited, and I just think that this book is so much fun to present. It's enjoyable to present. So let's think about this idea of being holy. That's sort of my premise, my foundational argument for the need to study this book is that we need to be holy. So just think about that word, to be holy. I am not a grammarician. I don't do much with grammar. We homeschool. My wife keeps me far away from the kids during that time. But just think about this idea of holy, the word, you know, it's the same word as saint, the noun form, to sanctify, sacred, set apart. Anytime you read those words, those are all synonyms, just in one form or another. But it's talking about that same thing of being holy. That's what the idea of being holy before God means, being set apart, being special to God, separated from the world, but not just from the world, but separated to God. You know, we're not just away from God, away from the world. We're with God, and so those two things need to go hand in hand, right? Tell me, other than holy, tell me some other characteristics of God. When somebody asks you, well, what is God? Well, what do you think of? Just shout it out. Powerful,
loving.
Love. Okay. Majestic, okay. Just. Righteous. Sorry? All present, okay.
Merciful,
okay. Yeah, all of those things, all of them are true. And we could probably go on for a long time just to sit and dwell on that a little bit, maybe think about some passages, think of some events that, you know, God's speaking or acting, and we think of a lot of different characteristics of God. But you know, it's his holiness, I'll make the argument, that is most emphasized in Scripture. A lot of us would remember this, maybe not everybody in the room. Bob Dole, right, when he was running for president, he had a platform, very basic argument that he would present, the flat tax. And so in his speeches, he would get up and he would pound his podium and he'd say, 15%. 15%, 15%. And that was just sort of, I don't remember hardly anything about Bob Dole, but I remember him really emphasizing that point. Why would he say it like that and repeat it? Because when you repeat things, they stick in people's minds. It's giving emphasis. When you say things over and over, it makes people remember them. See, I just did that. Think about God's holiness. In Isaiah, the 6th chapter, you have the calling out, holy, holy, holy. Same thing in Revelation, holy, holy, holy. God is all of those things, and we don't want to underestimate any of the characteristics of God. But it's only His holiness that is stated 3 times. I think there's something to that. Somebody else could say, well, how many times has He called something else? Okay, we can make other arguments about other characteristics. But I think this is an argument. You know, this is a point to be made. It's only His holiness that is stated to the 3rd degree. Why is that? You remember, like in the Gospel of John, Jesus would often say, depending on your translation, truly, truly, I say to you, or verily, verily, I guess the King James Version, right? Were the other things that He said not true? Yeah, yeah. This is really true. You need to pay attention to this, right? There you go. Exactly. That's right. And so that's what we've got here. That God is holy, holy, holy. The word holy is used in, you know, your number will, your mileage will vary depending on translation. The word holy is used about 637 times in the Bible. In the book of Leviticus, it's used 95 times. It's roughly 1/6 of all of the places that the word holy is used is in this book. Think about what I'm trying to present here concerning the importance of studying this book. The book that emphasizes the most emphasized characteristic of God is talked about the most in the book that we study the least. Something's messed up there. You know, it's not the easy book to study. I get that. But it is so rich. And it's begging us, if you want to be holy, then you need to study this book. That's what this book is all about. And so the book isn't about, it's not about sacrifices. It's not about laws. And it's not about prohibitions. Those are all contained in it. But the book is about how to come into God's presence. God, who is holy, holy, holy. We don't just slide in to His presence and say, hey, I'm here. Everything's cool. No, we don't treat God like that. We have to come in pure, or else we're not going to come in. Again, I'll pause. Any thoughts there? Let's dig into some examples of this. And we will come back and talk about, probably next week, Lord willing, an outline of the book and sort of how to break the book down into some different sections. I'd like to do that. But really what I'm wanting to do is get this foundation of why the book is so important. Maybe I don't need to convince you. There's probably some people that I do have to convince. I mean, that's just been my experience. The people just haven't really felt the passion, the need to study this. How many of you all have ever done one of those read the Bible through in a year? And, you know, you go through Genesis and you've got these great stories, you know, Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel and Noah and the ark. And, you know, you get through the Tower of Babel and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph. And then you turn into the story of Moses and the book of Exodus and you get those plagues that are going on and crossing the Red Sea. And then you get to Mount Sinai and, you know, you got some chapters that are kind of like, okay, well, we're going to plow through this, you know, that all those instructions about how to build the tabernacle, you know, in chapters 25 through 31. And I make my way through there, get to a couple of the chapters that's really interesting about the golden calf. And then I've got all those chapters almost repeated again about building the tabernacle. It's like, well, why is that? You know, it's okay, I make it through. And then I get to Leviticus, and what is that, about the middle of February or so. And you start to get those winter blahs of, I got to read through Leviticus. And that's the mindset that a lot of people have with this book. And we need to not have that. Look over at Leviticus 11, if you would, with me, please. Just glance at Leviticus 11. After giving it a good glance, raise your hand if you want to volunteer to read the chapter. Probably not. What do you find there? Just like, give me a quick summary. What's in chapter 11? I'm sorry? Yeah, all the things you can eat and you can't eat, and all these different animals that are prohibited from eating. My son cooked a bunch of bacon for us this morning. I was so thankful that we're under the New Testament. So you've got all these things that are prohibitions. And again, it's not just real exciting to just read through this list. But why is this list given? Look down. Somebody read for us verses 44 through 47.
For I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am holy. You shall not make yourselves unclean with any of the swarming things that swarm on the earth. For I am the Lord, who brought you up from the land of Egypt to be your God. Thus you shall be holy, for I am holy. This is the law regarding the animal and the bird and every living thing that moves in the water and everything that swarms on the earth, to make a distinction between the unclean and the clean, and between the edible creature and the creature which is not to be eaten.
Okay. So he's just finished talking about all these different animals that can and cannot be eaten. Verse 43, you shall not make yourselves abominable with these creeping things. Don't be defiled by them. The end of verse 43. And then he says over and over in this section, right? Verse 44, you shall be holy, for I am holy. Verse 45, you shall be holy. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy. Verse 47, to distinguish between the unclean and the clean. The rules aren't for, they're not for health purposes. God doesn't give these rules because they didn't have refrigerators back in the day. That's not his reason for giving these prohibitions. They didn't have refrigerators in the first century either, and man was told that they could eat them. Sometimes people make this into some sort of health issue. And that's not what the text says. Text says, so they'll be holy. But especially that last verse there, to distinguish between the unclean and the clean. I think that's the point of this. God's giving them an object lesson. He's presenting these animals and saying, these are some that you can eat, these are some you can't eat. And what I want you to come to understand is, you need to distinguish. You need to be able to make determinations about what's clean and what's unclean. We do that sometimes with our children, right? We give them object lessons, really not so much worried about the lesson itself, but about teaching something that's deeper, something that's more profound, something that's going to be more longer lasting even. I think that's what God is doing here. He's giving these prohibitions so that they will learn. I mean, that's what he says. So they will distinguish between what's clean and unclean. Let me jump into this a little bit, and feel free to disagree with me about this, okay? Does this passage about eating and not eating animals, can you think of anything in the New Testament that would be sort of a similar situation? Similar text? Yeah, in Acts the 10th chapter, right? Peter's there at the house. It's about lunchtime. He goes up on the roof to pray while they're fixing the sandwiches. And as he's up there praying, the sheet is lowered down, and all of these different animals are on the sheet. And this voice, "Arise, Peter, kill and eat." "Not so, Lord. I've never eaten anything unclean." Happens three times, right? And the sheet's lifted up, and Peter's like, "What was that about?" The text tells us he was trying to figure out what it was about, right? And there's some Gentiles at the door. Message for Cornelius, from Cornelius. We were told to come. An angel appeared to Cornelius and sent here to take you back. And Peter's told to go. Look over at that text. in Acts, the 10th chapter, as Peter gets to Cornelius' house down in verse 24, and Peter's coming in, he meets Cornelius. Cornelius tries to worship him. Peter rejects that. And in verse 28, then he said to them, "You know how unlawful it is for a Jewish man to keep company with or to go with one of another nation. But God has shown me that I should not call any man common or unclean." You see, through the giving of these animals, God was showing Peter that men ought to be considered clean, that they can receive the gospel. You see that? So it was through the giving of the animals that God was teaching a lesson greater than just what he can eat. God wasn't so preoccupied about whether Peter could now have bacon. He wanted him to understand it. And Peter was able to make that application. He said, "God showed me that I shouldn't call man common or unclean." Well, it's the same language that's being used back here in Leviticus 11. So why Leviticus 11? Think about what's going to happen for the nation of Israel coming up, right? They're at Mount Sinai. They're thinking they're going to leave Mount Sinai and go into the Promised Land. That's going to take a while, right? But when that next generation goes in, what do they need to learn? What's the application to Leviticus 11 for them? Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so they needed to make that application that we need to be holy. We need to be separate. We need to not act like those of the seven nations that they were supposed to drive out, right? You know, getting ahead of ourselves into the book of Joshua. But that's what they needed to learn. And I think, to me, it's really helpful because when I read Leviticus 11, I see the prohibitions. I see all these different animals that they couldn't eat. And I see that idea about distinguishing. But I'm sort of left just by itself. I'm kind of left with, well, what is that object lesson? But when I get to Acts 10, then I'm able to make that connection. But the same thing is true for me when I'm reading Acts 10. Like, well, how does this sheet being lowered down teach him about that? Well, because I know Leviticus 11. So now if I can think like a Jew, if I can think, put myself in Peter's sandals and sit there and try to ponder, what's this message? Wait a second. Back there, God told our people not to eat these animals so we can distinguish. Okay, that's, you see how all of a sudden the bells are going off, the light bulbs illuminating for him. That's one of the helpful things about this book of Leviticus, is that we're able to make connections with other passages in the New Testament and other passages in the Old Testament as well. And it helps us to see the importance. So sometimes we do have to sort of work our way through the first 43 verses of this. And there's animals there that I can't pronounce. I don't know what they are. I may or may not have eaten some of them before. I don't know. After being in enough countries, I never say I have never eaten a certain meat. But just not that I know of. But it's not so important that I know what every animal is. It's that I understand what the point of the text is. I should have said this earlier on. Using the book of Leviticus like this, taking Leviticus 11 and then thinking about other passages like Acts 10 and putting those together, because at least for me, they seem to go together. I'm trying to do just what Peter was doing. Peter was pondering in his heart about what was the meaning of that. Well, that's what I'm trying to do as well as I study through it. So you may not agree with me about every application, and that's okay. We're just trying to ponder through this together, though. But I see the book of Leviticus kind of like an encyclopedia. Now, we don't use the book forms a lot anymore. I don't know if any of you all have them in your house, but you remember, like maybe in school and, you know, right, a lot of times right in front of, at the library, there'd be a stack of Encyclopedia Britannica or Collier's or some of those encyclopedias. I would always see them on my way out. Never really stopped to study them. But generally speaking, you don't just grab an encyclopedia and just start in page one and just start reading, do you? There may be somebody that does that. Okay, That's great if you do that. You're smarter than I am anyway. But that's not how we usually use an encyclopedia, right? How do we use an encyclopedia? Yeah, it's a reference. And so you learn what's in it, like, you know, not necessarily everything, but you know that it has all these facts that are going to help me to understand something else. And so maybe you'll turn there and you'll read something. But generally speaking, you don't just keep on reading. It's not like a novel or an action kind of book or something like that. You don't just keep reading unless you're sort of just struck by it. Sometimes I'll go to an encyclopedia and I'll begin reading about the Roman emperors or something. And then all of a sudden, before I realize it, I've gone way past the emperor that I was wanting to study. I've studied six more just because I find it fascinating. Well, you may do that sometimes with Leviticus. I find myself doing that. But Leviticus is kind of a reference book. But you have to know what's in the book. I mentioned earlier, you know, Wenham's quote that the book is the first book that they taught their children. It's like ABCs and 1-2-3s. Now, you don't go back and keep reading 1-ABC-ABC. You don't keep reciting the alphabet. But you do use it as a reference. You know, even if you don't turn back to it on a page, you know, sometimes you come across the word you don't know how to pronounce, and you think, okay, I need to work through this, how those vowel sounds go and so forth. And so you have this reference in your mind. Well, that's kind of the way that we need to use Leviticus, I think. It's not the book that you're just going to sit down and just read one page after another. I don't think that that's mainly the point. Now, you need to do that to begin with, to get the context of the book. But after that, you're going to use it a lot of times as a reference. You're going to be studying Acts 10. You're going to think, wait, that reminds me of this other event, for example. I forgot to put that up. Let's look over at Leviticus, the 19th chapter. Leviticus 19. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to all the congregation of the children of Israel and say to them. Let me pause right there. You see what it says? This is not pertaining to the Levites. That's just if I can say this with humility, that's just a bad title, pertaining to the Levites. This book is so much more than that. The very last verse of the book, Leviticus 27:34, it's to the children of Israel. And you'll see that all throughout the book. It's to the whole nation, just like this is here. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to all the congregation of the children of Israel and say to them, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Now, I have up here the Ten Commandments. Where are the Ten Commandments in the Bible? Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5, right? And Leviticus 19. Leviticus 19 is sort of it's in my form. You know, you have the Ten Commandments given in structured form in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5. But here it's sort of in conversational form. I remember an older preacher a long time ago, he was trying to insult me. We're really good friends, but, you know, that's what friends do, right? And he said, you're just a conversationalist preacher. And I said, well, thanks. I appreciate that. That's all. I want to talk to people. So that's good. He was disappointed that he didn't insult me more. But that's what Leviticus 19 is with the Ten Commandments. Look at the instructions that are given here. Look at verse 4. Do not turn to idols, nor make for yourselves molded gods. That's the first and the second commandment, right? Look down at verse 12. You shall not swear by my name falsely. That's the third commandment. Verse 3, every one of you shall revere his mother and his father and keep my Sabbaths. That's the fifth and the fourth commandment. We've already got the first five commandments right there, right? You've got the sixth commandment, verse 16, you shall not go about as a talebearer among your people, nor shall you take a stand against the life of your neighbor. Don't commit murder. Don't take a stand against the life of a neighbor, the end of verse 16. Committing adultery, I'm going to use verse 29 Maybe that's not the point here. Again, I think this is sort of in conversation point, conversational language. Do not prostitute your daughter nor cause her to be a harlot, lest land fall into harlotry, so the committing of adultery. Verse 11, you shall not steal. That's the eighth commandment. Nor deal falsely, nor lie to one another. That's the ninth commandment. And then the tenth commandment is not to covet. And so in verse 18, you shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the children of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I think an application to that would not be covetous toward your neighbor if you're loving them as yourself. So you don't have the exact same language. You know, you're not going to take Leviticus 19 and create tablets and, you know, have them written. They're really just mixed up. You see that? But, I mean, at the very least, I mean, I think there's an absolute argument for eight of the Ten Commandments here. And I see pretty clearly nine and maybe ten. To me, that's really impressive to think about. You know, we've got the Ten Commandments. We teach them to our children. I don't know if you guys ever learned the song. That's how I learned practically all of the list that I know in scriptures are because of songs, right? I wasn't raised by Christians. And so when I became a Christian in my 20s, I started attending the children's class. They had it on Sunday afternoons, and they would sing these songs, and I'd be sitting in the back trying to keep up with the four-year-olds. And eventually I made it. I'm as smart as a four-year-old. But man, those songs are really helpful. But you can't do Leviticus 19 with a song. But it's important to have Exodus 20 and to be reminded of it in Deuteronomy 5. What would be... Again, we're just sort of pondering. Do you see the Ten Commandments here? At least, you know, an argument for several of them, right? Why have them, like, just all mixed up? What might be a reason for that? And they're off. Scott? Exactly.
As Jesus said, all along the prophets. And it's like the robbers broke the Ten Commandments. The priests and Levi didn't break and destroy the Good Spirit. They didn't break the Ten Commandments, but they broke this broader one.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah, good point. What else? Yeah. Yeah, it's not about just doing, you know, he says don't cross that line. I didn't cross that line, but I got it to there, that sort of mentality. I think that's a very good point. I like the word you used, discussion, there. That's probably a word that I need to adopt for this chapter. Yeah, yes?
It's more application-based.
Okay. It really helps us to see that it wasn't just the Ten Commandments, right? Yeah, yes.
The examples caused you to stretch when you're thinking about it. And as the 31 is, do not turn to mediums or spirits, do not seek to be out to be found by them, I am the Lord your God. And as you think about Saul, you think about the different times people talk about using them.
Right.
And they'll say, well, this is harmless, but it's not.
it's causing us to think less about the Lord, and at the very least, we're just a generation or two away from abandoning God and adopting that. But yeah, good point. Look at this thought through this 19th chapter. I think we'll be able to make this point. The end of verse 2, "You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy." The end of verse 3, "I am the Lord your God." Do you see that? "I am the Lord your God." The end of verse 4, "I am the Lord your God." The end of verse 10, "I am the Lord your God." The end of verse 12, "I am the Lord." 14, the end, "I am the Lord." The end of verse 16, "I am the Lord." Verse 18, the end of it, "I am the Lord." The end of 25, the end of 28, the end of 30, 31, 32, 34, 35, or, I'm sorry, 36, and 37. You have this statement over and over. I didn't count them. Was it probably, I don't know, 12, 15 times maybe in there? Either "I am the Lord" or "I am the Lord your God." Right? That's what he's wanting us to understand, that he is God. And so we need to follow these lessons, these instructions, these commandments without a doubt. But we need to follow them because he's the Lord. You know, think about our children. And we just know more than they do, even if they don't always understand that. And so we give them instructions. And sometimes when they don't understand, I have to say, "Because I'm your dad." Now, I don't take the position as a parent, "I'm the dad and this is my house and you'll do as I say." I think that's kind of harmful in my judgment. I want them to do it because I'm their dad, the relationship that we have, right? And I think that's what God is pleading with here. Remember that Leviticus 19 is given at Mount Sinai, same as Exodus 20. They're both given at Mount Sinai. It seems to me that Exodus 20 was given first. I'm surmising that. And so he's given these laws, and then he's kind of had a discussion. Laura used that word a while ago. He has a discussion about them. This is really valuable. Do you see how this book just has a lot of meaning for us? It's kind of like, you know, Leviticus 19 is kind of like the Sermon on the Mount in some ways. You know, it's just a discussion about all kinds of principles that are given. Wow, I made it about halfway through one lesson here. So either I'll have to talk faster or skip some stuff or do better. But thank you all very much. Appreciate the opportunity again. And seriously, if you have any questions, disagreements, comments, or whatever, please feel free to let me know. Thanks.